Welcome to Protect Earth News Magazine podcast, a product of elected officials to protect America. Throughout the show, we will be speaking with local elected officials about their municipalities and districts and how specific and contemporary environmental challenges are felt within each. In this episode, co-founder and executive director of Elected Officials to Protect America, Alex Cornell DeHoo, speaks with Representative Felix Ortiz, Assistant Speaker of the New York State Assembly. Representative Ortiz shares his nuanced perspective as an elected official on immigrant and citizen issues, environmental racism, and the nexus of veteran cooperation on these tough debates. Building off the Protect Earth News podcast conversation in the first and second episodes, Alex discusses the relevancy and immediate importance of a national stimulus that also focuses on clean energy and environmental protection. All this and more in our interview. Here's Felix Ortiz.
Well, my name is Assemblyman Felix Ortiz. I have a role as an assistant speaker of the New York State Assembly. I was elected back in 1994, so I've been serving for 26 years in the Assembly. I have seen a lot of changes throughout my district for the last almost 30 years, if you say that, for diversity and community as a whole. I also have seen so many of the challenges that we have faced throughout the years. You know, one of the biggest challenges that we first faced was the 9/11 attack, where the legislature had to come back and really reinvent the wheel, if you will, regarding funding for first responders, where we had to really allocate funding to ensure New York City could not go into bankruptcy. And the second wave happened to be with Sandy, when we had that big hurricane that hit Red Hook. I represent the areas of Red Hook, Sunset Park, Bay Ridge, Borough Park, Pass Slope, and also a little piece of Cabo Hill. And the area that was impacted the most happened to be Red Hook, where you have a total of 52 building, 2,900 unit, which is called the New York City Housing Authority, public housing, where 10,000 people live there. And the majority of them are about 65 years old. And most of them are in a lot of disadvantage regarding health issues. And that was another big impact that we went through. And lastly, right now what we're facing, which is something called the invisible that we cannot even see, it's called the COVID-19, which really had taken everybody by surprise, and really the whole globe has been impacted by something that we still cannot see, and we're still fighting back. So it has been a very interesting year of services regarding all these challenges that have happening in my community. And as you probably know, COVID-19 demonstrated one more time that our Hispanic community are the one that has been impacted the most, not just because of the virus, not because of Sandy, not because of 9/11, but because continue to be a big inequality on how to allocate funding and resources to our community. So those are some of the major challenges that I have faced, and more to come.
I'm sure there always is. If you were to talk about a couple of your successes, what would you love to highlight?
Well, I will say that when I first started my career, I tackled the issue regarding a sweatshop. The abuses of what I call the underground industry, and I, as a result of holding public hearing on this issue, 3 months after that, the speaker appointed me to be the chair of the subcommittee on sweatshop, and that really gave me a lot of opportunity to really tackle this issue and bring the injustices to light. And as a result, I put together two books. One is called Behind Closed Door One, Behind Closed Door Two, And that's really explained in very detail all the testimony of even kids of 14 and 15, 16 years old back in 1995 that was working on the in this industry, not in Honduras, not in China, right in my backyard in Sunset Park. So I unveiled that. The other thing that is very interesting, when 9/11 happened, New York State just to give driver license to everybody, you know, whether you undocumented or not, and they decided to stop driver licensing for undocumented. And then we've been in my district, we have a lot of taxi drivers that was driving without their licensing, and they will have getting involved into accidents. So another bill that I introduced was calling for undocumented driver licensing using the ITIN number, allowing these people to come out of the shadow and to have their insurance and everything else. And the other one is about Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act of 2019, which would give tenants the opportunity to have the protection that they deserve and not be evicted and to ensure that they will be able to be protected. And the criminal justice reform passed this year, we has to do with repeal of 50 Alpha, and that is to create transparency of prior disciplinary actions record of law enforcement. That was a huge one, because all the incident that was happening was no transparency within the department, and also bang of shock holes by law enforcement officers. That was about time, as you probably know. Gardner was the first one that got a shock hole, and everybody got away with it. So we decided to pass that bill, and also prohibiting of false race based on 9/11 phone calls, false reporting, where people that you probably know about the 9/11 call that was making Central Park by this young lady about a black individual. So I put a bill. I had no idea I had a bill back in 2017, that was as a consequences of a black man working in a campaign in Minnesota. A white person called upon him, the police, and reporting that he was stealing, and he was putting it. What he was doing was putting posters on the land, and so I introduced a bill saying that any false reporting should be a hate crime. So New York State passed that bill, and that bill became to be the talk of the town throughout the country. And another bill that I think is very important, you know, all the issues that I have worked on environmental, the fossil fuel, for example, banning fracking, another issue that I got involved. And the other issue that has to do, which people know me also very well, is about banning cell phone from driver, where New York became to be the first in the country. And the first around the globe, and test messaging will be saving so many lives.
And well, that's quite the list. I'm sure more to come and influencing as we move forward here. And impressive, really. You've been working very hard for the people of New York and the nation, really. When New York was the first state in the nation to ban fracking, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
What was that process when you didn't have the backing of other states and others to get the governor to sign it and the legislature to move it forward?
Well, the biggest challenge first that you have is really the governor to come to in agreement to ensure that we be able to put it in place. Just keep in mind that the governor at this point is fighting, trying to see also looking at what happened in Philadelphia, where Philadelphia is doing the fracking. And we're paying attention to that. The great news that happened here is that the advocate was very consistent. They came, they advocated, they stayed together, and everybody was united. When you have one voice among thousands of different advocacy groups coming together on one particular issue, this is how things happen. Convincing the Senate was a little bit tricky because despite the fact that we have a Senate that at that point was Republican, then transformed into Democrat, but the Democrats, you still have some Democrat in some areas in New York State that are more moderate than others. So where fracking was important for some of those senators who lost the election against the Democrats. So that Democrat had to play in a very safe way and in a way that we'd be able to get this done. So we came up with some strategies on the to ensure that number one, that the member will be protected. Number two, that the fracking bill will get done. And it was based on negotiation back and forth and trying to build the consensus. And we finally we came up with the agreement and we moved forward and New York State became to be the first in the country.
And what do you think about the influence of elected officials coming together to say, hey, governor, this is really important? I think 1,000 elected officials signed a letter to the governor and working together. It's like, this should be a priority.
Well, it's a combination. It's a combination of both. It's a combination of always keeping your ear to the ground, to the groups, work together with the advocate, work together with experts that you as an elected official, before you even sign a letter, that you are informed. And every single elected official is on the same page. Remember, in our case, we have 150 assembly members, 63 senators. We control the Senate by 39 right now, and we have the assembly by 109. So even though those numbers sound very impressive on the Democratic side that we control both houses, but also it's a lot of a consensus that you have to build among these elected officials to, because everybody come from different region, different areas, different part of the state, that some areas are more moderate Democrat, conservative Democrat, maybe you can say moderate Republican, where you can take advantage of a Republican to ensure that that Republican will vote with the Democrat. So all these take. But that is the beauty of public policy and politics. Is when you have a bipartisan few of the other Republican voting on a bill that that they feel is important. You know, we have people in, for example, in Long Island, two Republican senators who lost the election to a Democrat. But you know, they was pro environment. They believed that, that we needed to do the right thing in regarding environmental issues. But nevertheless, one of the success of all this is to make sure elected officials have the information that the elected official will be able to meet and to have a better understanding about galvanizing the information from the experts, and the experts will be able to facilitate to also to the advocate. And then we create a group from the outside to the inside and from the inside to the outside. And then we will be able to educate and the members who have not a knowledge about a particular issue. So any issue can be done, but it has to be done in a way that you need to engage members, members need to engage their community, people need to understand the community of where the members come from, and then be respectful that way to ensure that we be able to build that consensus. That was how we managed to get this bill done and this letter signed to the governor by ensuring that everybody understood the issue, the impact, not just only the impact in the community, but the economic impact that that will have in the entire state.
Yeah, that's a really, really solid point, ensuring that the members are able to have the right information to educate their constituents too. Yeah. Because there's some of these issues, particularly on the environment and say divestment, right? Yeah. They get a little bit complex. And I believe you had a divestment bill in recently.
Yeah, well, the what we call the Fossil Divestment Act is it's divesting from the pension funds. You know, we have our controller DiNapoli who has making some little step and trying to really divest. But the reality is that we have to identify who are the major players who are holding back on this bill not to move forward. You know, right now we are working with that's another important bill because we're talking about pension and everyone said, well, don't touch my pension. You know, don't deal with my pension. I deal with my pension myself. But in reality is that we cannot continue to have our money from the state to be invested in groups that are counterproductive to our state and our environmental future, such as fossil fuel. So we have to make sure that we can develop a mechanism and continue to have a conversational life with the with the controller on how to phase out. You know, we have about over 1,000 countries who have already divested. You have some major companies who have begun to step to the plate and say, we are divesting from fossil fuel. We are not going to invest there anymore. And if we all pay attention to what happened with COVID-19, during COVID-19, the investment in fossil fuel went down. So show you that we don't need fossil fuel. You know, we don't need to invest in fossil fuel. So this is a very interesting walk that we're taking. We finally have a very majority of senators sponsoring the bill in the Senate. We are up to 69 or 70 sponsors in the Assembly. You know, it's like pulling teeth, because you really have to educate the members on this one. What is the impact going to be? Because then whoever the opposition is, they're going to come strong to ensure that, you know, they begin to put their teeth on it. And at the end of the day, what I tell everyone, especially everyone who really would like to be a sponsor of the bill, look to your own community and look to the community that have the highest asthma rate, bronchitis rate, respiratory problem rate, and tell us, how can you help us to diminish this kind of pollution in this community? And also identify what kind of community we're talking about. At the end of the day, you're going to find out that most of this community happen to be the community that continue to be disenfranchised, minority community, Black, African American, and Hispanic community, where they jump all the major highway to be built, where they using as a dumping ground for the sanitation garage. You know, and when you look around, you know, it's all polluted. So it's a process that we are very happy where we are now with the numbers. I think we need to do a little more work, but we have come a long way to for members to really have the courage to sign on this bill despite the fact of what the opposition is.
Well, I'm looking forward to see that bill move forward, because again, it's one of those bills that can lead the nation in what is really important moving to ensure that we're not investing in really volatile industries that are really, from a pension standpoint, I don't want an industry that's kind of going up and down and up and down. And kind of speaking of the larger sense, in the nationally wise, there's some potentials for some COVID stimulus to focus on clean energy, other types of investments in the infrastructure. What's your perspective on that? Is it to have the importance that that's included?
Well, I think we need to make sure that the federal government really pay attention to the state. You know, it's a state and municipality collapse. It's the federal government will go down. I think that what the federal government need to do is to concentrate to ensure that, you know, the days of FDR has to come back. And the days of FDR, you know, when the Great Depression took place in the 1917, 1918, you need to mobilize and give financial resources to those who has been hit the most. And it's throughout the country. You know, you give to every 369 million people living in this country, take the rich people out, take those who make the millionaires, and then take the population that need the money the most and give them a paycheck on the monthly basis that they will be able to use that money to reinvest back to the economy, and also to help them to get out of the anxiety, desperation, and depression that they're going through because of the economic financial situation that they're in. So we need to use the opposite. You know, rather than being talking about reducing the $600 for unemployment to $200, and you know, we know that we want business to open. We know we want business to flourish. We know that we want business to do well. But at this time of this COVID-19, which is a lot of uncertainty moving forward, the best way to do this is to invest in the people of this country by giving them a check, not to depend on it, but to at least have the resources to move forward with their family. Secondly, I think the federal government need to be looking more into thinking out of the box, more into job creation. And the job creation has to do with solar panels, you know, how to train people to deal with solar panels, how to train people or retrain people to deal with wind energy. So we need to be creative in a way that the federal government had to step to the plate to give the state resources to begin to train and to think about our future. Not to think about now, but to think about our future. Today is about investing and giving money to our people. Tomorrow is about what train do we develop today for tomorrow and for the future, that we be able to have these people that are home now, unemployed, and working from home, especially the unemployment, and those who are probably looking for changing their profession, and this will be an avenue to do that.
Absolutely. Kind of going along with the clean energy investment, I believe Governor Cuomo has postponed the $3 billion environmental bond November. What is your perspective on that?
Well, I think that is very, very important that we need to tackle the environmental issue that is happening in our state. We cannot depend on Washington. We cannot think that Washington is going to come together and give New York the opportunity to liberate them from resources that are needed today to ensure that we will be able to take care of our state. I think we have to take measures and we have to move forward to ensure that we be able to comply with the legislation that we passed already. By 2050, we're looking forward to make sure that we have a better environment for our future, for our children, and for the future of the next generation. So I think that we need to be more proactive than reactive. We need to make sure that we be able to secure that our future generation is going to be better tomorrow than we are here today. And I think we need to continue to work together, the three branches of government. The governor, sometimes we have to make sure that he stay on the same path.
Absolutely. When it comes to the people who are hit hardest by COVID, by environmental racism, what can we be doing better? Like, what should we be focusing on here?
I think we have enough proof as we speak about what already we knew. It's nothing new that anything negative that might happen in our city or state or country is going to impact those people that never been taken care by giving them the financial resources that they need. Number one, we have to strengthen our healthcare system. We need to make sure that in order to ensure a better future for everybody, United States, including New York State, and the territory, should have one healthcare plan for all. That we don't need to be choosing between going to the best or the worst doctors or the worst hospital or the best hospital. You know, that everybody will be able to have access to healthcare. That's number one. We need to deal with this issue. You know, if you have, you know, if you have a good health and you have a good healthcare program, then you can take care of yourself. And I know that if you take care of yourself, you will be able to get what? A good education, then get a good job. And then if you want to buy homes, you buy your own home. And then you have, you're living the real American dream. But we cannot be excluding people and continue to have this racism and discrimination that continue to happen and exist in our country, in our state, and in our municipality, where only some people will be able to have health insurance, other people will not have health insurance. So that's one issue that we have to deal with. The second issue that we have to deal with is we have the best opportunity to really to, in our country, to ensure that every single one of our children will be able to have at least a physical and a mental health assessment or exam. How do you do that? You do that by enhancing and expanding a school health-based clinics in every school where you will be able to have a nurse, mental health practitioner, a psychology mm-hmm. practitioner, and I'm talking about separate from having guidance counsel or counselors. You know, you have that unit, especially now with COVID. You know, if you're going to reopen schools and you're going to look, you're looking to move forward to the future, so you need to have, and you have, you know, we have it. You know, we have, our school system should be used as three components. Number one, to assess our children, every single children, whether you're undocumented or not. You assess them physically, you assess them mentally, and then you provide what they need. Secondly, you will be able also to use the same mechanism to do the same type of assessment to the parents. Okay? Number three, on the COVID, we have noticed that some schools throughout the country has opened to what? To provide breakfast and lunch. And to some extent in my district, we're also doing dinner. And we invite everyone to come. So the school system have a better way for us to really use if we really have the vision and the understanding on how to take advantage of that building. And that building is a huge building. You know, I give you a quick example quickly. You know, in Puerto Rico, when we have flood, when we have hurricanes, when they come, where do the refugees go? The refugees go to the schools. The school is already put in place with the kitchen in place, with mattress in place, and you have all these people staying where? In the school system, they don't have to worry about breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They're already getting it there, you know? So it's the same model that you can use now on the COVID, and the fact that we're using this in COVID now to give breakfast and lunch and dinner to some extent, and now we're trying to reopen, I think, you know, we have to develop a better metric and a better system on how we're going to be continue to do testing for COVID-19. And all these trays and all this stuff can be done through the schools as well. So we don't need to wait until opening 300 centers. You know, in my own district, we have a total of six schools. Let's use the 26 school, and if you have 1,000 student average in every school, you're already toppling 26,000 kids. And plus, if you're going to add the family, assuming it's three in the family, you're already doing a total of 100,000 people in one shot, in one community. So you will be able to do it if you really want to do it right. So is it the way of doing it is there. The issue here is whether we want to continue to fight among ourselves on financial resources, and also if we want to continue to depend on Washington. So you know what? We're not going to go nowhere. Lastly, I would like to say that a combination of two things. Number one, nursing homes, and the public housing. And why I'm combining both? The reason I'm combining both is because most of the people that live in the housing developments, public housing, happen to be people of the age of 55, 60 years old above, where they also have a lot of chronic diseases. And they are more sensitive to catch COVID-19. Same thing in the nursing home. So we have to do a better mechanism on how we're going to deal with this. And you see, it's not difficult to do. You know who these people are in the housing development. You know who they are. Do you have a database of every single person that lives there, yes or no? And if the answer is no, then go do it and do it. You have the resources. And if you don't have it, just put it in. And that's another avenue where, in the situation that we are now, COVID-19, you can trace, you can test all those 10,000 people, by the way, in a very short period of time. So I think we need to really have a bigger vision. We cannot have a shorter vision. We need to think big and then begin to narrow it down to our community. And then take an example from my own community, what I did during COVID, to the big global picture.
Absolutely. You had mentioned Puerto Rico, and sadly, Puerto Rico has been hit by a number